Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are in the world. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly lightning meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polysbon, and I'm joined today by Harry Jacobs, Zohar Atkins, Nicholas Sarion, and Francis Pedraza. Welcome, guys.
Good to be here.
The quote of the day that we're going to read, Harry's going to read. Harry, would you tee us off with that?
I would love to. A lot of times, people don't know what they want until you show it to them. Steve Jobs, as quoted by Hamilton Helmer in The Seven Powers.
Francis, have you found this to be true with Invisible?
Of course. So for small improvements, like today at the coffee shop, I had ordered my first coffee and I wanted a second one. And I tried to order from the table and she said, sorry, you have to go back to the register. And I just gave her my card and she said, sorry, you have to go back to the register. That is something where, Nico's embarrassed because he grew up here. We're in Buenos Aires. But this happens. It's not a Buenos Aires thing. It happens all over the world. People get stuck in a box of the way things are done, and they stop listening to customers and customer feedback. So we as entrepreneurs try to build cultures that are service-oriented, where you're not, blind and deaf to the market, to market signal. So let's call that step one of building a good business is supplying demand. And therefore you want to listen to demand and respect demand. But what Steve Jobs is saying is that there's a level two. And level two is creating supply that there's currently no demand for. Nobody even knows that they want it. They haven't imagined it yet. And you're imagining it for them. How do you do that? That comes from, yet again, a completely different level of listening. So in level one, the person at the coffee shop was not listening and seeing that customers don't necessarily want to get up from the table and pay every single time they want to order a new thing, right? There was a level of blindness and deafness, right? And if they had a very level one sight and hearing, they would make this quick fix. But if they were Steve Jobs, they would always be seeing and always be listening and always be thinking about human nature. And they might have a leap, a sudden enlightenment, an aha moment. Everyone has these flip phones and Palm Pilot has this weird personal computer that's in your pocket. What if there was, oh my gosh, an iPhone? It's an iPod, except it's a phone. It can do everything. And then you go from there. And then he literally went down a tunnel. And I'm sure they worked on it for 2 years. And the thing about that tunnel from a business point of view is it's full of risk. You imagine if an Apple shareholder in that period of time was watching the money clock, was watching all the money going into this crazy R&D project. And Apple at the time did not have as much money as Apple has today, right? And so all of the CEO's time, all of the team's time is going into this crazy project. And you're like, please explain to me why this is a good use of shareholder capital to come up with a new product that there's no proven demand for it. And we ran a survey and it turns out nobody wants an iPhone in 2006 because it doesn't exist. Right. That moment, that is the moment that Steve Jobs is talking about. And the question is, okay, when Steve Jobs did it, it obviously worked. It's a multi-trillion dollar product that he built, right? And he did that not just once. If it was once, you could say it's a miracle or it's an accident, but he did it again and again. So the question is, how did he do it? And how can we do it? Because just climbing a mountain, there are more ways to die than there are ways to successfully climb it. I'll stop there and just ask the group, like, he did it more than once. He was a level two seer and a level two listener, and he was able to discern human nature and go through the tunnel and successfully get out the other end. How did he do it?
I was going to just say one thing as I think back on this, and I just finished with Seven Powers, or most of Seven Powers. And in 2007, when the first iPhone came out, it was a tremendous thing. And you had guys like me who, at that point in time, were, I don't want to say scared of technology, but I remember it when 2006, I was carrying a BlackBerry in one hand and a phone in the other. It was almost like the separation of church and state. It scared the daylights out of me to think, why would I merge my email device and my telephone? Those things, just as you were talking, I'm thinking back to the book and I'm thinking about, where was I in 07 when that first iPhone came out?
Yeah.
It was right.
And it's easy to see that it now, that how ridiculous that concern or fear was. But sure, at the time, it was a totally reasonable fear. And by the way, we're always in the blindness of now. And for example, 20 years from now, we might all have chips in our heads that we've installed that give us natural access to the internet and to Zoom calls. So we don't even know what the future holds. We're in the blindness of now. From today's point of view, that sounds like the scariest thing in the world. Our grandchildren might know nothing else. It might sound like the most obvious thing in the world. And so it's hard to, on this side of the leap, it's hard to even imagine what's on the other side of the tunnel of the leap of faith.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant statement, Francis, that we're in the blindness of now. But to me, as I think about that, and I'm sorry to monopolize this, but as I think about the Jobs quote, a lot of times people don't know what they want until you show them. I talked about this last week. I was a C student in high school. I didn't go to college. I became an entrepreneur. I went and did a bunch of different things. I had no idea about philosophy because I never got to that level. And to be now a part of this team of people that's creating meditations and this library and everything else, I had no idea what I wanted. I had no idea that I would have an interest in philosophy. And it's almost like a quote at a time for a guy like me. And I like being a part of this because all four of you are so knowledgeable about philosophy.
I'd say I'm more in the same boat as you, brother.
Yeah, but I think you all embrace philosophy so much and want to spread the word, so to speak. And guys like me, whether they're 57 years old or whether there's someone that's 18 or 20 years old, exposing them to this, even quote by quote, is something that is particularly meaningful. So I've taken on not only a job to read meditations and to read books, but I've also taken the opportunity and am taking the opportunity to get an education about philosophy. And that to me is particularly meaningful and something I never would have expected.
When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. It sounds like you're ready.
I think that I am.
I wanted to weigh in a little bit on this quote from a philosophical perspective because it touches on a paradox that any creator is familiar with, which is when you're creating, are you discovering or are you inventing? The ancients, I would say, had a bias towards discovery, and moderns have a bias towards invention. So what's the difference? So if you listen to the word discover, you'll hear that it has an discover. You're uncovering something. So the idea is the thing already existed. All you're doing is removing the layer. I like to think of a metaphor, a beautiful metaphor that I recently came upon in the work of Ibn Battuta, a 10th century Jewish philosopher, that the purpose of thinking is to polish a gemstone that is caked in dirt. And so you have to basically remove the dirt, and then you see, wow, I have this thing in front of me, but it was there the whole time. As an aside on that point, he compares the teacher to the person who helps polish the gemstone and the student who owns the plot of land where the gemstone is found, but where he doesn't think that it's worth anything. And in my cynicism, I said, why didn't the teacher just buy the land from the student and take the gemstone? But in the analogy, it doesn't work because the gemstone is the soul. So you can't actually buy someone else's soul. But the solution to this problem is the teacher gets a call option on the student's upside. So even though it ends up being a win, where even though the student gets to keep the stone, the teacher gets some kind of credit or some kind of bonus for enabling that discovery. In any case, ancients love this metaphor of uncovering. In Greek, anamnesis means recollection. And Plato defines truth as the experience of remembering what you already knew. You knew everything before you were born, then you're in the prison house of earthly life, and then you have to recall your prenatal experience. And the Talmud has a very similar teaching as well. There's, I don't know if you guys see this part of your face. It's called the philtral dimple, that little indentation right underneath your nostrils. The Talmud says that when we're in the womb, that is not, that little dent isn't there. It's just, we just have a perfectly flat part of our face. But then an angel comes and puts his little finger there. And what we have, this philtral dimple, is the trace of an angel touching us. And what the angel's doing, he does that right before we're born, is he's erasing our hard drive so that we come into the world ignorant. Because before we're born, we know everything. So now we're in ignorance, and we have to spend our whole lives recovering what the angel erased. So in any case, that's
why when we're thinking, we go,
Yeah, exactly. But moderns, and Michelangelo is, I think, a famous example also of this idea of, hey, the David was already there. You just had to remove the rock to reveal David. But moderns use the language of invention, which is the idea that it didn't pre-exist. You rather bring it into being, and it wasn't there before. And I think Jobs, again, I don't know, did he think of the iPhone more like he was Michelangelo revealing the David, or is he fabricating something that wasn't there before? But I think the language suggests a more modern disposition, which is aligned with the philosophy of pragmatism, which is that truth doesn't exist. You actually have to create the truth. Demand doesn't exist. There is no pre-existent demand. You actually have to create the demand. And the problem with Adam Smith's model of the prices where the supply meets the demand is that in that equation, supply and demand are uncorrelated. They're independent variables. Whereas if you get more postmodern, you could actually say that demand can be invented or created by supply. That's Say's law. Supply creates its own demand. A good example of this would be the more that people desire something, the more that that other people desire that thing, the mimetic quality of desire. To show people what they want is not just to show them a product. It's to be a witness for the kind of life that they want, that you are embodying by being the creator of that product or the user of the product. And maybe the real thing, this is perhaps too idealistic, but the real thing that people are buying when they buy the iPhone is the entire story of Apple as embodied by Steve Jobs. And of course, the functionality is nice. But that only comes later. That only comes once there's a network effect of everybody adopting Apple products. And now all of a sudden you can't not use them because you're disadvantaged. But how do you get your first 100 users, the first 100 people to use the iPhone and make it valuable, aren't using it because that value exists. They're just buying into this dream that has to be fabricated by somebody who's inventing the truth.
How do they actually do that? You can turn around the quote into the inverse. A lot of times people don't know what they want until you show it to them. That's Steve Jobs talking about the client, the user, the customer. But if you flip it around, you could say something like, rarely exceptional people know what everyone else wants and are able to show it to them. But obviously that's asking a question of like, how are exceptional people able to discern human nature, discern unused possibilities of technology, markets, etc., and manifest from the unmanifest? That is not the same thing as seeing the visible world. So I can hold up a glass and you can see it, but if I imagine something that doesn't exist, like the iPhone didn't exist before 2007, I believe it was, he was able to see it in his mind's eye, which is not his eye. He could see it with his eyes closed. He could use his third eye. And that faculty is what we call imagination or vision. And it's a creative faculty that artists have and entrepreneurs have, and ultimately everybody has. But just like some people don't go to the gym and don't do push-ups and therefore don't develop the natural muscle. Most people don't develop this muscle. He not only developed it, he was like Arnold Schwarzenegger in peak like Olympic condition, right? He was super buff, but he wasn't super buff physically. He was super buff in the imaginative faculty, right? This was one of his superpowers. But I want to, it should both be mystified and demystified, right? It's mystifying because it was so powerful and it's like a superpower, but it should be demystified in the sense that you have that inside of you. You have that kind of infinite creative potential inside of you. And it's even, it's staring at us in the face with just the idea of a blank piece of paper. Like when you look at a blank piece of paper, that is a meditation unto itself. It's so overwhelming. It could become anything. And when you really meditate on the on potential itself, you start to realize that what is actual compared to what is potential is like one compared to a million or a billion or a trillion or infinity. Like it's the unmanifest is much greater than the manifests. But this still is, we have not still answered the question. How is it that a human who is just here in the physical world with a physical body and physical eyes and physical ears, here in the manifest world, how is it that we reach into the unmanifest? With what faculty can we do that and then bring something here from that invisible world into the visible world? How do we do this? This is a miracle that all of us are capable of, and it's totally mysterious.
Well, what if the hard part isn't actually getting the inspiration, but is just having the courage to share it? God, so to say, or if you want a more impersonal version of it, the sort of metaphysical realm of Platonic ideas, gives you a lightning bolt. Okay, that's not a big deal. But then taking that lightning bolt and having the courage to say, I have a lightning bolt, and I want you to know that I have this, and I also want to keep my head down and focused on capturing this lightning for a long period of time and doing a whole bunch of annoying things because I believe in it, and building a team so that we can scale this lightning and dealing with all the rejection, the setbacks, and all the people laughing at us saying that we're absurd, etc. So I think it's, I guess my view on it is, of course, there's a skill set in being imaginative, and we would all do well to go to the imagination gym. But even if we did, just to continue the metaphor, there's a difference between having nice biceps and knowing how to fight. Mm-hmm. And plenty of people go to the gym, and yet they might get wrecked by somebody who's far less strong, who simply has the courage to actually brawl. I think Jobs' superpower and the superpower of many entrepreneurs is the tenacity to get beat up and show up again to get beat up again.
Yeah. Because there'll be times that you don't make something that someone wants. Forgive me, I'm going to use a very recent example of today when there was a change made to the Library of Alexandria that wasn't
by the way,
that was meditation
for today.
That was completely independent. If the individual wants to speak on this, they can. It was a completely independent and entrepreneur proactive decision to make, and it ended up getting rejected by the power that be. And how do you, like Steve Jobs, that must have happened to him, I don't know how many times, but then he decided, no, I ultimately I messed up this time, but next time I'll get it. So I'm going to try again and show again. I'm going to take another proactive step. And most people, especially when they're kids, this happens, they test out and feel the waters, and then they're slapped on the wrist, and then they retreat to themselves and they never come back out. I think that's what Zohar's, I just wanted to add that to Zohar. Like, how do we not only have the courage to step out, but after failure, do it again and again?
And I think the problem with Zohar's point is that we go back to Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor. The people who manifest end up in jail or in a madhouse or whatever. There's only a few of those lucky ones that are called geniuses instead of crazy people. No, and that's the point, is how do you distinguish one from the other? No,
I have a thought on that. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah.
So when Francis was talking, I did go to a similar place of how do we know Jobs isn't just one of the lucky ones and there's survivorship bias. For every one Steve Jobs, there's 99 who are so committed to showing people what they wanted, but for whatever reason, they just had bad luck or bad timing or just their thesis was wrong. And like they were totally noble and totally from first principles, but for whatever reason, their iPhone was rejected. And we don't hear about that. So there is that possibility. But I also went to a more idealistic place, which is, what if it really is just so rare to be a madman that part of what allows you to succeed is that other people see that madness and they find it intoxicating because they want to be mad too, and they want permission to be mad, and you're giving them that permission on some level. So the product isn't just the utility of the product, it's also the story of your own struggle to stay with it, and then people like a good hero story. So
right.
I think that
Jobs died, right? There's my way of handling the quote, and with what Zohar said, is I think there's two ways of understanding this quote. One is fairly easy, and we all are conversant in this, is there's such a thing as, we always talk about mimesis, right? Desire. Where does desire come from? Just from looking at another person and what they desire. Kant said this, no? But the idea that there is no way you can pinpoint where the desire for something comes from. It's just the fact that someone else likes it, who knows why, and that's it. So the idea of Steve Jobs coming with the iPhone and saying, hey, here's the iPhone. Maybe he thought it was gonna fail. In fact, the iPhone only became a success after, I think, the fourth iteration or the third one. Look at Apple Vision Pro for that.
How's it doing?
Is it not doing well? I think they're like returning, they're starting to return the Vision Pros now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I heard the other day. Yeah, I don't know, but that's what I heard.
I don't know.
But if you want to take that route, why isn't Steve Jobs the scapegoat in this whole, right?
Because he was kicked out of his own company and then he came back. And many people loved working with him because he was so demanding, and many people found him impossible.
Yeah. Because I was going to say, many people managed to sell what they could never give away.
You have to be an extreme character to produce extreme outcomes. And if you're an extreme character, then you're contrarian, not just in your beliefs, but in your tendencies and your habits and all kinds of things. And we all want to be contrarian and right. Not we all, but those of us who are contrarian want to be contrarian, right? You can also be contrarian and wrong. So I think that perhaps the reason why we are afraid to capture lightning in a bottle has to do with the fact that we don't want to be contrarian and wrong. Another answer to the question of how could you be a Steve Jobs is that you don't have a choice. That's a less motivating answer, but you often find about certain artists, you say, why did you starve yourself for 30 years and then you finally got your success? Like, how did you know you were going to be successful? And some of them might say, I'm thinking of Cyrus here, it's not like I starved myself because I thought I was going to be successful. I just starved myself because I didn't want to get a normal job. Like, I couldn't bring myself to do it. So do they even get the credit for the heroism, or are they just being true to their nature? Some people have an abnormal nature and other people have a very normal nature. Like,
perhaps the heroism is staying true to your nature.
The heroism is staying true to your nature. But like, Francis, do you think that some people have the nature of, I'm just going to be a rule follower and work my way up the corporate pyramid and I'll become an SVP at McKinsey after I put in my 30 years. And so being a great, authentic person is actually just not deviating from that. And then for other people, it's just not trying to be that, if that's what you're not. Or do you think that everybody has this kind of inner child that is visionary and imaginative, but most of us are not actually free because we take this sort of short-term and superficial reward offered to us by societal standards of success and status and all of that, and we give up the kingdom of heaven?
Oof, you love asking really big questions. I guess we have founder product fit. Can I answer by sharing a story that comes to mind from my own life in the last year?
Please.
Yeah. I was going to say no, but.
All right, I can say
yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, you can.
That's why we're here.
Last January, I hired a CEO to run Invisible, which is the company I had been running for 8 years at that point. And because a whole bunch of reasons, but one of the things I was hoping was to be able to leave my apartment because I was just stuck there working all the time. And I wanted a more balanced life. And Ben had a very strong first 6 months in the job. And I finally went on my first vacation since building the company. The previous summer, I tried to go on a vacation, but then we got our biggest client ever and I was working the whole vacation. So I went to Bali, all the way in Asia. And I went there mostly to deepen my yoga and meditation practice and also to search the unknown. If you look at a globe, New York and Bali are literally on like exact opposite ends. So I was like wanted to go to the other extreme. And I go to this yoga class and this teacher leads a class. And at the end of the class, your body is tired, so your mind is ready to receive. And he led us through a chanting exercise and then a teaching exercise. And what he said stuck with me. And he was a Shiva follower. And Shaivism is a branch of Hinduism. And they take the idea of reincarnation very seriously. And I'd like you, even if you think it's a crazy idea, I'd like you to take it just as an intellectual exercise for a minute. Instead of thinking that you're so different than everybody else, these in Kashmir Shaivism, they believe that you literally are everyone else. Everyone else is you in a future life or a past life. There's only one person here, just you. And the reason why that is such a powerful but also scary thought is it's like Shakespeare being in all the roles, right? Shakespeare not only wrote the play, he's now acting as this role, acting as that role, acting as this role. And this is something, Cyrus, you might have an insight to as an actor. You know what it's like to embody or indwell a role. So let's go back to the Steve Jobs quote. There's a lot of acting in it. A lot of times people don't know what they want until you show it to them. The implicit thing is that the person speaking that sentence is interested in serving other people. The statement, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, that may be true, but the opposite is also definitely true, right? The road to heaven is paved with good intentions. But one of the things that's fascinating about the world is how 8 billion people have completely unique intentions. Like, I have a different intention about my life than Nico has, than Zohar has, than Harry has, and than Cyrus has. That's why we have completely different life paths. Completely different life paths. Everyone's going down a different life path. Steve Jobs followed a very specific life path. And part of the path was this idea of inventing things that would not only serve people in an ordinary way, like getting me my second cup of coffee without having to go up and pay at the register again, but serve people in an extraordinary, mind-blowing way. Now, given enough lifetimes, we all might end up in that state of mind and with that intention, right? Partly through exhausting all the other possibilities. But it's an interesting question. How did Steve Jobs even get into that state of mind? Because the default state of mind is certainly not service, it's selfishness, right? It's much easier to be served than to serve. And the default state of mind is not to move towards the extraordinary, it's to stay in the ordinary. So this particular individual, this particular soul, in going through life experiences, somehow ended up coming to this place where he wanted to serve and do so in an extraordinary way. Now, when your intention is super strong, you eventually work through all the issues involved and you come up with this. You deal, to Zohar's point, you deal with 1,000 rejections, 1,000 failures to somehow figure out a way to actually break through. But you can't break through unless your intention is incredibly strong. And the question is, why did he even have the intention to do such a thing, to serve and to serve in an extraordinary way?
I'm going to be extremely cynical and I'm going to be devil's advocate here, but I think that, I don't know when this, I think this quote is after the fact of the iPhone.
Yes.
So exactly. My point being that did Steve Jobs know, did he have a clear intention or were he just like trying out the market?
But why was he trying out the market?
He still had the same attitude before.
One thing I was going to say is that I think, and this is the second way I think you can analyze the quote is, Yes, the question, your original question was, how do you know what people want? No?
Yeah.
How did he know? And that's, nobody knows. I don't know what I want.
Yeah.
But I know something. I think people know something. And what they know is that they know what they don't want. Mm-hmm. It's much clearer. And it's fairly easy to, let's say, just singularize that into one thing. People don't want to suffer. They don't want pain. And you can... And that's markets of beer.
You're saying you could work backwards from that?
Yeah. If people didn't want to suffer,
yeah,
then why does anyone do anything hard, like becoming an entrepreneur or becoming a Navy SEAL?
But they do everything in life not to suffer. I think most people, I wage my claim that most things that people do, even if they don't think about it, it's like, why do you want to work? You know, I don't know. I'm not myself, but it's
right, but
extremely unconscious, I think. But I think generally... Like the driving force behind any form of action is reduction of suffering, more than maximization of pleasure. Like it's like in the whole samsara thing, it's move away from dukkha. That's what people want, not sukha.
And remind me, dukkha's unhappiness. Exactly. Yes, happiness.
Dukkha is
but then there's the question and the realization that maybe there is no such thing as moving beyond a happiness or unhappiness,
right,
if we base that in the material world.
Yeah, but if I'm an entrepreneur and I'm trying to make money, what do I care?
I think which is an interesting point.
Yeah, we're selling illusions. That's the whole point.
Yeah, like, illusion's a great subject. Illusion's a great subject.
I'm not saying that's bad because anyway, you mentioned Kashmiri Shaivism. Kashmiri Shaivism doesn't say, oh, illusion is a bad thing. Let's get rid of it. No, let's use illusion to achieve.
Talk to me slowly. I'm a boomer. but I wanted to say two things to, and part of this goes back to what Zohar said, and that is, and this comes from a Nike commercial, and that is, and I saw the commercial and I was really moved by it. Greatness is a belief system, right? It's something that's really within inside us all, right? Yeah. It's a matter of what do we have to do? It's almost like you ask about Jobs and what was it that possessed him to do that? That's within him. That greatness was within him. And you're in Bali, or you spend time, a lot of time in Bali, Francis, as you said. Think about Eat, Pray, Love for a minute. Think about what Katut said, right? He said...
It's a movie. It's a movie for those of you guys who haven't seen it.
Yeah, a movie I never thought I would watch, but what he said was...
Julia Roberts, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
what he said was the only thing... And what he said was the only thing we can control is our minds, right? So if that greatness is within you and you don't allow yourself to grow, that's, I guess that's my, those two things come to mind as I'm listening to you guys talk through this. And it's a different, maybe a base perspective as the unphilosopher that I am. I think both of those things have meaning and application to this conversation.
Both of those two examples, the Nike example and the Eat, Pray, Love example, frame the difference between following and leading or inventing. Let's just say you want to become great at yoga. You can go find instructors and they will show you the path. You just need to follow the path and be disciplined about it. If you want to do the Eat, Pray, Love journey, you can literally just follow in Julia Roberts' footsteps, so to speak, in Elizabeth Gilbert's footsteps. Mm-hmm.
Our lightning guided tours.
Exactly. We could do a lightning guided tour. What's really impressive about Steve Jobs inventing the iPhone is that no one for him to follow. He went out into the jungle all by himself and somehow came back with fire. He's like Prometheus.
Yeah. You know where the apple comes from, right?
Ah, the Garden of Eden. Yeah.
No.
Tell me. Well, the Beatles song.
No.
Okay.
It's this guru.
The guru?
Yes, you didn't know this.
No?
I don't remember the name, but so Jobs, he went to India.
Yeah.
I think I have a friend of mine who is doing a PhD at Columbia in religion and he studies South Asian religion, whatever. He went to India and he told me, I went to Jobs' ashram. I was like, what? Yeah, where the whole Apple thing came from. Apparently there is this, I have to look it up. There was this guru back in the day, and Jobs, when he went to India, he went to this guy's ashram. And the guy, every time someone would ask a question or when he would do his sermons, he would throw apples at people. Yeah. Hit people with apples. And that's where Apple comes from. It's a meeting. Just, I don't know. Like,
he threw the iPhone at us.
You didn't know that you wanted an apple thrown at you until it hit you in the face.
Yeah.
You reported the guru to HR, and the settlement claim accreted to you for generations, which you then spent on.
In fact, I think Jobs wanted money to Daesh Ashram. So there you go.
Now, speaking of like throwing apples, right? Because if you look at many masters in spiritual traditions, they do things that are meant to snap you out of your everyday consciousness. And I have to be careful how I frame this, but basically, if you believe in that guru's power and are willing to submit to it, might be for your benefit and might be really profound. But if you don't, might be really damaging and really harmful. And there's a certain ambiguity as to whether the guru is pure. And maybe the guru is pure but still damaging, or maybe the guru is corrupt and motivated by ego. But if a guru breaks your arm, is that abuse or is it enlightenment? I think most in the modern West, having more rational and skeptical perspective, that's abuse. And yet when you look at stories of students submitting to their masters in the ancient world or just in non-modernized Western context, they see it as devotion. There are stories that, it's very complicated, but stories where you, if you're an outsider looking at it, might say the teacher is torturing the student in some way. But in another context, you might say that the student is being elevated beyond himself and stretched to a point of self-transcendence by this. So who's in the right? I mentioned this book on one of our episodes in the past, this book called An Ambiguous Adventure. I really recommend it. It's an underappreciated memoir or fictionalized memoir about a guy who grows up in a tribal village in Africa and then goes to Paris to study philosophy and then basically decides that he doesn't want to be an intellectual and hang out with Europeans in cafes talking about philosophy. He wants to go back to his pre-modern village and save his tribe. And the book ends with him being a lunatic and a madman as the French come and pillage the village. But he grows up, he's a prince, and his king, his father puts him up for adoption and basically has the local sage tutor him. So the king, this was common in the ancient world where you could be born to parents, but the parents would sacrifice you, not physically. They wouldn't literally kill you, but they would give you up for adoption in the hopes that you could become a more holy person, since it's not in their wheelhouse to do that for you. Mm-hmm. So he goes under the tutelage of this taught to recite the Quran in such a way that the sound of his voice would be as if, I think Harry can appreciate this as a reciter, he was meant to recite the Quran as perfectly as if God himself were singing it. And he was put through physical discipline, what do you call it, corporal punishment, until he achieved this level of perfection. Now, I know we moderns in the Montessori and unschooling approach might say something like, the whole child matters and follow your bliss and this and that, and follow your curiosity. But do they produce people that can sing the Quran as beautifully as if God himself could sing it? So I'm not sure that internal motivation as a child gets you to that level of excellence. And I think that is another way of really bringing into the fore the radicalism and the extremism of those who are contrarian, and how you really have to be willing to be villainized. So I'm not really advocating this, kind of am with a wink. I'm just saying that everything in life has a price, and the greater the reward, the higher the price, the greater the sacrifice, the more uncertainty, the more doubt, the more ambiguity, the more volatility, all of these things have to be introduced. Otherwise, everybody would do them, and then there would be no premium. So you can get beta, just to switch the metaphor, very easily by doing what's consensus, and that's fine. Beta's great, but if you want to outperform, you have to be willing to have a drawdown sometimes of 60, 70, even 80%. You need perhaps you even need to go to zero a few times, only to then develop the resilience to know that you can come out of it.
So I have a question. What if, let's say, my interest is not so much going the distance, but setting the price? Because that's what we do, I think. I want to show you the way. I don't want to walk there. I just want to show you where to go. That's what you're talking about, is like step two.
One of my favorite teachings in the Talmud, which is of a piece with this concept in the Eastern tradition of sudden enlightenment, and that relates to our logo, the lightning bolt. Boom, you're enlightened. It can just happen, whether you're ready or not. So the teaching is some gain their share in the world to come, some which is paradise. Some gain their share in paradise over a lifetime. Others gain it in an instant. And the story that teaches this principle is basic contrasts a rabbi who spent his whole life teaching, studying, doing good deeds, compounding a few percent year over year, living a pretty decent life, and his executioner, a Roman executioner, who put him to death. But in the moment that he was commanded by the Roman state to put this rabbi to death, decided that he was going to give this rabbi a humane death and quicken the flames so that he didn't suffer too long. And you would say, how is it that they both get paradise and one spent his whole life doing good deeds and the other was an executioner? But I think the point is, this is a very important point. The essence is not the outcome, but the delta. We aren't measured for what we achieve. We're measured for how we change. The executioner's pivot from just being an executioner to having that one moment of humanity and intervention was worth, in God's eyes, the same amount as all of that rabbi's good deeds compounding minimally year over year. So we can't compare ourselves to other people. We can only compare ourselves to our own most potential. And some of us are like the executioner, and we can still get that sudden enlightenment. So even if you've had a messed up life, there's always the hope of right now. And at the end of the day, if you are open to that, then you can have one moment in your life that is the decisive moment. You can have one moment in your life where you do the equivalent of you creating the iPhone. Not all of those moments amount to the creation of a $1 trillion business or a product that millions of people use, but in God's eyes, it's all the same.
I was going to add to that because I think it's analogous. We always talk about this, but do you think this ties to the idea of success being measured not by your achievements, but by your capacity to fail? And what I mean by the way you manage the failure? I guess you can speak about that as well.
Yeah. I don't know what success is anymore. this is the slipperiness of words. And this is actually a good stage in philosophy, is where you get to a place where you just want to be silent because any sentence starts to sound strange. Have you ever had this happen even to a word in English where you see the word on the page and it seems like it was written in another language?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have. And there are times I spend a lot of time reading for the library that we're building. Mm-hmm. And there are times, and sometimes it's almost knowing my own limits. I'll be reading for 3 hours straight and I will see very basic words and I will begin to make mistakes and think, what is that word? It's just, you know, there are times it happens to all of us, I think.
Even take a word, I just see a word on the screen, background. Back, like my back. Mm-hmm. Ground, like mm-hmm. the ground. Does the ground have a back? What does it even mean? I don't know.
It's almost like it's the wrong word, right?
Yeah.
The wrong two words, right?
Where are you going with this, Francis?
Where am I going with this? The question of success. What is success? How do we measure this? And when you deconstruct, when you enter into a childlike mind, where you don't have any preconceived ideas, you start to realize, okay, I know Nico. No, I don't. Like there's an alien here that is someone I could get to know. I could be talking to Nico for 1,000 hours and not be done knowing him.
I don't know myself.
Then, exactly. So you don't know yourself. I don't know myself. I think, oh, I'm 30, about to turn 35 in a few months. Like I know the world. I don't know the world. And so let's go back to the reincarnation idea. We all think that we have a very limited lifetime. And I think it's very helpful to think that way. It's very helpful to realize death can come at any moment. That's one of the things that will catalyze great insight and frame everything. But it's a very powerful thing to think that actually you don't have a limited amount of time. If you don't learn a lesson in this lifetime, you'll learn it the next one or the next one or 10 lifetimes from now or 100 lifetimes from now. Eventually you'll learn it. And let's go back to the thing from Harry, the Nike thing, or the Julia Roberts Eat, Pray, Love thing. We can follow in the paths that others have led before us, right? We can become a basketball player and try to follow in the path of Michael Jordan. We can become a yogi and try to follow in the path of Patanjali. We could be a traveler and try to follow in the path of Elizabeth Gilbert or Julia Roberts. But some people tread a path that nobody's tread before. And then whose path are they following? Let's just take Euclid. Think about a math problem like 1 + 1 = 2. We think we on this call understand what that sentence even means. I don't necessarily even think I understand what 1 + 1 = 2 it means, but let's just say we all do and we think it's a simple problem. Life is not a simple math problem. It's not a + b = c. It's not 1 + 1 = 2. It's like a math problem. Have you ever seen a math problem with 50 variables? There are math problems that are too hard. They break your brain. Even if you get a spreadsheet out, your Excel skills, your Google spreadsheet skills are not good enough to solve the math problem. Then you take the math problem to the best mathematician and it's too hard for them to solve, right? That's what life is. And you take Euclid. Here's a guy who wrote 13 books of geometry that all start with the simplest possible problems and assumptions and the building blocks. 1 + 1 = 2. Okay, what do we know from that? All right, we know that. And he defines a point. He defines a line. He defines the basic properties of a square and a rectangle and a triangle. And from that, he builds 13 books of geometry. He achieved, it's like the first man who climbed Mount Everest or something. Like he was doing that for geometry. I think given enough time, we go back to nature and mathematics is a form of nature, right? And we confront it as the great unknown and we confront it with the attitude of a child, which is the attitude of wonder. And it's only once our mind is so good at convincing us that we know what that is and we know what that is, and it deletes things so that we can't really see them in the first original way. When you eventually get back to that original vision, you start to see everything as really strange. Like a table? What's a table? A background? What's a background? A Nico? What's a Nico? A triangle? What's a triangle? That is the state of mind that Steve Jobs was in, because otherwise he wouldn't have been able to enter into the unmanifest and make something manifest. That is the state of mind of a creator.
People don't know what success is until you show it to them. Euclid had a bunch of really great ideas, but the friction, yeah, quote me on that. That's like that's for TikTok. Yeah, he was pretty dope. Yeah, good ideas. Really cool.
How and I was told there'd be no math today, so I'm going to bounce from this right now.
180 degrees in every triangle, that's nice, bro. But the friction between discovering the principles of mathematics and writing them down, I don't believe there's a lot of friction there. It's okay. You do have to show up and do the proofs, and that's hard, but the hard work is all in the thinking. I'm going to put on my yawn emoji and diss Euclid for a second. It's cool that you came up with all that stuff, bro, but did you monetize? What's your business model? How did you capture value? Like, you open sourced that? You fool.
You did, though. That's the whole point. Why you
no. It was your lead gen strategy. You wow them with your geometry, and then they hire you to be a consultant. Okay, I got it. All right, fine.
But everyone remembers his name.
But Jobs didn't just have an idea. Okay, like the iPhone is a cool idea, but people have ideas all the time. He executed the idea. And execution is the thing that differentiates the theoretical genius or the contemplative genius, say a Euclid, from the modern genius, which is the man of action. Hegel actually writes about this. He distinguishes, let's say, Socrates from a Napoleon. There was a time in history where status accrued to people who were teachers. And in the modern world, status largely accrues to people who make stuff happen. It'd be nice to live in the world of philosopher kings where Socrates is also a general, perhaps. But we typically find that those who are great at execution are not great at thinking. It's actually very hard to be a Euclid and also care about execution. The reason, I believe, is Because if you love ideas, then you want to spend all of your time on those ideas. You just want to focus all of your energy on your alpha, which is like proving that three sides of a triangle equals the whatever. But Steve Jobs optimized not just for having an idea, but for actually realizing it in the world, for manifesting it in the world and creating a social change. So I think that's a unique and different kind of genius. And my hat off to that, because as a thinker by nature, I think it takes yet a completely other skill set to go and manifest and make it happen. And maybe this, so imagination is part of it, tenacity is part of it, but I think execution and whatever goes into execution is another reason that separates the successful Steve Jobs from the raving lunatics. Yeah. Like Francis,
it multiplies the complexity to a profound degree, right? It's an n-dimensional space. In 1 + 1 = 2, if you make a mistake on that math problem, it's so simple, you can find where the mistake is. But it's not at all simple to find where the mistake is. For Invisible, 4 years in, the company seemed like it was a failure. And then that was actually the turning point. So can you imagine if we quit like a month or two before the turning point? And so there are these very delicate things. And the amazing thing about advice is we have many advisors and I get a lot of advice. But advice is never, the more advanced the game you're playing, advice is not binary. It's not, I am 100% sure you should do X instead of Y, and you should follow these steps, X1, X2, X3, X4, X5. Nobody gives you that type of advice, right? You're walking in an environment where uncertainty is just deeply pervasive. So how do we walk at all? And this goes to the idea of intuition or calling, which is a gift and a form of listening. You look at Steve Jobs' life, it's really good if you've never done it to read a series of biographies. Don't just read one biography. Go on a biography binge. And the more stories of lives you read, you get this weird sense of like, how do they know to turn left or turn right? These lives have these really bizarre twists and turns. Look at Zohar's life, right? Like rabbi, road scholar, tech futurist, entrepreneur. Look at Nico's life, right? Surfer, South America, North America, entrepreneur. Cyrus's life, like Hollywood, Silicon Valley. These lives are strange. My life is strange. And there's this way of realizing, like Steve Jobs said, it only makes sense looking backwards. 10 years ago, I could not have told you how the next 10 years would have played out. I could not have told you I'd be here. And it's more wonderful and strange than we can imagine. And so there's this sense of we are the agent, we are the doer, we're the captains of our own destiny. But there's also this sense in which we're the observer. And there's a lovely line in the Gita where Krishna tells Arjuna, it is better to do your dharma, which is your calling, your destiny. It's better to follow your destiny halfway well than to follow somebody else's. And that's tremendous because it gets at the just unbelievable complexity of what a human life is, right? And the number of ways you can go wrong or right are infinite. So going back to this, the main quote here, people don't know what they want until you show it to them. If there's an infinite number of options, it's a needle in a haystack to show them the iPhone. The only way you can hope to find a needle in the haystack, you need to find some sort of a strategy. We all need a strategy to find needles in haystacks, even though it's impossible. So what's our strategy? My strategy needs to be different from Nico's, and Nico's needs to be different from Zohar's. We all have a needle-finding device. That needle-finding device is our intuition. What's that? I don't know.
As you were talking, Francis, I was thinking about the fact that every day we put out a meditation from a different sage who's no longer alive. And you were talking about advisors and how advisors give advice, but it can never actually perfectly map onto your own life and your own intuition. And so there's a certain paradox of why do we seek advice given its shortcomings? Why do we read books of the dead and listen to meditations of the dead, given that they lived in a completely different time period and had a completely different psychology and set of concerns and soul map than ourselves? And I think, and this is a view that I have yet to fully articulate, but I think a lot about, tradition and existentialism go hand in hand. People think that existentialism means rejecting tradition and carving out your own path. But in fact, tradition gives you case studies of other people who have sought their own path before. And so what you're trying to emulate is not the content. It doesn't matter whether Spinoza was right or wrong. What matters is that he aspired to be a free thinker. And now you can try that on and decide for yourself, was he right or wrong? And in so doing, you can become a free thinker. So perhaps there's something in these sages where it's like they are all examples of outliers, and you're trying to absorb the character of their own ability to be outliers and figure out how you can apply it in your own life. But it's not actually about the worldview that they're imparting. I don't know. I just feel it's very strange that in 1 minute, one sentence, we can be quoting the Bhagavad Gita and in the same moment basically be saying that you have your own path and nobody can tell you what to do. If that were really, then why are we so committed to reading and to thinking with others? So there's something there about alterity and the weird way in which other people and other texts provide mirrors that then allow you to better see what your path is. And yet you don't want to just try to replicate it, but you need them.
I was just going to say, there's something to be said also for whether you look at it from a business and strategy perspective, as Francis was talking about, or from a personal perspective, right? This board of directors, advisors, whatever they may be, that's certainly one piece. But I'll give you my own personal perspective on this as someone that's brand new to philosophy and is still at 57 years old, finding his way through life. You develop relationships with people. My relationship with Zohar is brand new. It's 2 months old. Yet every time I talk to Zohar, I'm motivated to learn more either about myself or to learn more about life and the world. I'll give you an example. He gave me a quote last week after he said something very complimentary to me on a day and in a moment that I needed those words more than I ever have in my life. And it was essentially words that come from the heart. You can finish it for me. Go to the heart. And it was a day and a moment that I needed it. And I'm learning things day by day sometimes and moment by moment sometimes. And for that, I'm exceptionally grateful.
Thank you for sharing that. By the way, real men cry. Zohar made me cry yesterday as well, so you're not the only one.
Yeah, it's important, right? It's important whether we're listening to people that are our own personal board of directors, which Zohar is quickly becoming elected to in my world, or we're listening to business advisors, right? We don't know where that advice, that counsel is going to come from. When I was invited on this podcast, I said, I don't belong in this group. I'm not deeply philosophical like you are, Francis, or Nico, or Cyrus, or Zohar. I don't belong here. And then I quickly realized that I come from the perspective that maybe folks like me can help to show guys like me that aren't into philosophy, that can't quote Heraclitus or any of these philosophers, Plato, that maybe it's one quote at a time to bring you to see the light of why what we're doing is so important to the world, to what we are as men. How do we become more noble? How can I become? I read these quotes and Zohar will say, boy, you did a great job with that. But then he'll say, what was your takeaway? So I'm not just reading, I'm being asked the question, what's your takeaway? And to me, this is a wonderful experience from that perspective.
Life is asking us, what's your takeaway?
Right.
Maybe that's good.
The idea that anyone isn't a philosopher, life is philosophical. We are thrown into this bizarre thing. And some people choose not to confront it like an ostrich. Philosophy is the scary thing of actually admitting that we are agnostic in the sense of we don't know. And there are questions that we can't answer. And yet we do need to know enough to put one foot in front of the other. And that is, if I may, Cyrus, I'll give my final comments. I know we're wrapping.
Yeah,
my final comment is that in the 20th century, there was this great envy of science. And there was this false understanding of science and what science is.
which is the assumption that somehow everything could be turned into a machine and everything could be solved and all the questions could be answered. And that is not actually what science is about. It's about questions, because science is actually one of the children of philosophy. Just like economics is a child of philosophy and technology is a child of philosophy. Philosophy is very strange because philosophy doesn't have any final answers. It just has these questions that keep arising generation after generation. And the idea that once a solution is invented, it can get better, faster, and cheaper. Like, I've got an iPhone 14. It's already outdated. I think there's an iPhone 16 or something. There's always the next thing. It gets better and better. But the amazing thing is that even though economics is the science of trade-offs and scarcity, we're not living in a zero-sum world of trade-offs. We're living in a world of abundance, because some people like Steve Jobs are able to transcend the trade-offs through innovation, through reaching into the unknown, through reaching into the space of questions and pulling something back that actually is like a boon from the gods. It's like Prometheus stealing fire. Is this offering of, you know what, you thought you were living in a world where you had to choose either the Palm Pilot or the flip phone, but actually, here you go, right? You don't even need a calculator anymore. You don't even need an iPod anymore. It's like the iPhone is like 1,000 products in one product. Here you go. That's a miracle. There are miracles all around us. If you were an alien watching from outer space, compared to all the other species on the planet, you'd be freaked out about the human species, because what is manifest is like this scraggly little being. But what's unmanifest is all the stuff that we keep popping, exploding out of our brains, these cities, these products, these things. Where does that come from? It comes from the unknown, the darkness within darkness, gateway to all understanding. It comes from the doubt, comes from the emptiness. And so my takeaway from today's conversation is just to sit more in be comfortable in the discomfort, which is the human condition.
And be present. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Be present. Conversations like this, dialogue like this. Cyrus and I talked about it at the beginning of the call. Everyone's got their faces in these wonderful devices that Steve Jobs created, 1,000 different things in one. But being present and allowing yourself to think and see a different perspective and soak it all in is so incredibly valuable.
Nico, do you have anything to say?
I was going to say that the piece of technology that is under your phone has been still relevant for the last 2,000 years and is still around.
Which is?
The table.
No.
What is it?
A book.
Before Zohar makes his closing comment, I just want to say a small thing. I think directors are visionaries who have original ideas and who execute them into reality, film directors. I think it happens every year. We just take it for granted. But a film is a miracle every time it gets made. Zohar, close us out, man.
The Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao. The thing that we think we want is not the true object of our wanting. And now I want to read a poem by Rumi that I think pairs really beautifully with Steve Jobs. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill, where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep.
Thanks for joining us today, guys. Have a good one.